right. Yeah, it turns out all right. So, for those that didn't know, Scott is not going to be here tonight, obviously. If you didn't know ahead of time, sorry about that. So, I've been teaching the teenage class, and the students from the teenage class are out here amongst us this evening. So if they have any recollection of things that we've already discussed, which is we're going to be going over a lot of the material that we've already gone through in class, feel free to raise your hand and interject any comments you might have. I'll expect to see a lot of comments from the teenagers. But so Scott came and asked me, say about a week ago, if I would be willing to fill in for him. And, you know, I'm not super excited about filling in on relatively short notice, but he said, oh, you can just go talk about the things you've been talking about in Bible class. So, thus, we have a class called Bible Geography. We have been talking about the geography of the Old Testament and into the New Testament in the teen class over the course of the last 6 or 8 weeks. And so we're going to cover a good bit of that, we're going to cover, try to get a good bit of Genesis done tonight to talk about some of the things that are interesting of note in Genesis from a geographic perspective. For those that don't know, geography is kind of is my profession. I know make maps is really what it boils down to. So this is kind of was right in my wheelhouse. And when I proposed to Scott to do it with the teen class, he was really excited about it. And so far, it's been a fun class for me. The teenagers are probably they like geography. But maybe not as much as some other things. So with that being said, so we're going to talk about geography this evening. If you have questions, feel free at any time to raise your hand and ask. Can't guarantee you that I'll have the answers. I'll give the traditional Scott answer that, you know, I don't know, but we'll look it up. We'll figure it out. But we'll go from there. So I guess the first question that I wanted to ask is, and you're probably asking yourself, why do I need to know geography? That's kind of it was something I learned in school and I don't use in my life. Why is it important to talk about? Well, I'll tell you, what geography is the study of places and people and things over time. So we're looking at the relationship between man and the creation, in this case, in Bible geography, specifically in Genesis. And we're looking at it over time and identifying maybe anomalies, some things that will give us a better insight as to what the time was like, the culture was like, the place that the events were happening was like. And it kind of gives us an insight that we couldn't get any other way without looking at the differences of the place. Even Scott mentioned a bit of geography in his sermon on Sunday, I believe it was Sunday night, and he mentioned that in the New Testament, when they talked about making a trip and they said they went up from one place to another, that meant they went up in elevation. So they traveled from one place to another, and it was typically higher than the place they're going. Or if they were going down, it was lower in elevation. So that's kind of, it's a little bit of what I call, and I told the teen class, it's a little bit of spice, to spice up the stories a little bit, to give you a little bit better understanding. So geography certainly will help us understand stories better, understand how and why things happen. It also helps us understand the culture, which influences all the behaviors. It also has some cascading effects through time, which is very interesting to look at. For instance, the transition from nations, world power nations, from the Babylonians to the Assyrians, Medo-Persians to Greeks to Rome, all of that transition included some culture shifts, and it's interesting to look at those changes and how that affected the geography, especially particularly of the Bible lands. And I think for me, the last thing, the why geography is important from a biblical perspective, it helps us understand God's love for us and how awesomely powerful he is. And without looking at it from that perspective, I don't think you get as much of an appreciation for the true nature of God that you could otherwise. So we wanted to start Genesis, and the only place where you can start in Genesis, and really the only place you can start a biblical geography class or a discussion is in the beginning. So Genesis 1:1, we know that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. So I put this slide intentionally to be blank. This is what where we are now looked like at that point. It was just void. That's what the author of Genesis says. And then God created the heavens and the earth, and thus the beginning of geography. So this is a picture. When I think of creation, it's really hard to wrap our minds around, and I'm so thankful for the class that we had just not too long ago over Genesis. And as we went through Genesis 1, it's just amazing to me to think about all the complexities that are happening in just a few words and all of the changes that are happening. But I digress. I don't want to go too much over the creation, because certainly we could spend more than one class just talking about that. But I do bring up the creation in relationship to geography, because this is where geography began. If we turn in Genesis chapter 1, and I did not, I'll leave it to the Bible class teacher to not bring his Bible to class. That's a shame. But I usually look on my phone, and I don't want to have to do that today. But in Genesis 1, in verse 9, this is when what I understand as geography began. Beginning in verse 9, it said, "Then God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and gathered together, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. And then God said, let the earth bring forth grass and herb that yields seed, and fruit trees that yield fruit according to its kind, and whose seed is in itself on the earth. And so it was so." And he goes on to create basically all the vegetation of life. So this is where that we understand today. So this is where God took the form that was the earth, it was kind of over the period of 2 days, went from nothing to a kind of amorphous thing to actually water bound up together, then to dry land. And so when this creation of dry land came, that's when we start to see the building of mountains, the valleys, the rivers. This is when geography was created. So on the third day, and this is a good question, if you ever get into like a very trivia class, what day was geography created? You'll know, third day. Third day is when geography started. But really, that's all I wanted to talk about, the creation, because again, I think that we could go on and on about the creation as it pertains to looking at it from a geographic perspective of time and place. We're going to move forward to, the first man. So actually, before we get there, maps are my thing, and so I really like a good map, and I apologize for this map. Although it's beautiful, it does have these watermarks that do kind of make it a little muddled. But life began and was sustained in this portion of what we know now as the Middle East. It's called the Fertile Crescent. For those that haven't heard that term before, it includes from the north of the Persian Gulf up around the Tigris and Euphrates River, going over to the Mediterranean Sea, and then down through what is in modern-day Israel, and then over to the delta of the Nile River. So this is where life began. It's kind of awesome to think that in this tiny little place, I mean, it's actually a relatively big place, we're looking at roughly 800 miles across, around from one arc point to the other. We're talking about 800 miles from here to here. So it's a big place, the size of the width of, almost the width of Texas. So it's a big place, but in the scope of things, if we were to zoom out, and I can just really quickly for reference, look at, from a global perspective, if this is the Bible land area, the Fertile Crescent runs here around the desert, between the desert and the mountains. It seems like a relatively big place, but when you zoom out and scale and look at the entirety of the earth, it's actually very, very small. And it's awesome to think that this is where life began. So this is where God planted Adam. And he, in Genesis, in chapter 2, is the description of where God provided a place for Adam to dwell. It's the description in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 8. It talks about the location, approximately, the location of the Garden of Eden. And Adam gets placed there. And we know the kind of the story. Adam gets placed there. And ultimately, his wife is created from his rib. and they dwell there in the land until the sin was, until sin was, you know, interjected into the situation and God had to remove them from the garden. But the description in Genesis 2 and verse 8, actually it's later on verse 11, it starts to describe these rivers that fed the garden. And we know one of them by name. We know, I think that the Tigris is, or maybe it's the Euphrates. Yeah, the Euphrates is mentioned by name, but the Tigris is, there's another name, the Pishon, I believe was another name for the Tigris River. So we know that it was generally in a certain location. So I want a caveat, and I should have done this at the beginning. Before the flood, it's really impossible for us to know too much exactly about the geography of the earth. Because you would imagine as we get moving forward, and we talk about the flood, and a global event where water covered the earth, changes everything. And so what we could call the Tigris and the Euphrates today most likely wasn't what the Tigris and the Euphrates were before the flood, just with all of the water kind of transitioning from on the earth to outside, off of the earth. There was going to be a lot of movement of river channels and even the bodies of water as they migrate. But I still like to know tangibly that this was a place on the map. And doing a little bit of research into it, you know, there's people that say it was between the Tigris and the Euphrates where I have pointed out here, somewhere in here. We'll never know the specific location, but it was fed by four rivers. The Tigris and the Euphrates were two of them. And so this is the place where the first man was started. I mean, again, when you think about that in the context of all our lives, we go back in time to the first man. It's pretty awesome to know that we can see him. See where it began, sorry. This feels like I'm feedbacking. So sin got involved. Adam and Eve got removed. They had children. And then Cain killed his brother. And I only included the Cain arrow because this is where we start to see, and what we're going to look at for this class is the movement of people. So Adam and Eve start in the garden. They are removed from the garden. They stay in that general vicinity. And the reason that we know that they're going to stay, well, one, we know where their descendants go. But two, we have to look at back at this map. If you look at the Fertile Crescent, there's not much option besides staying within this green area. If you go to the north, it's mountainous, very dry. You go to the south, it's flat and very dry. So there's not much opportunity for the agriculture that they'd be dependent upon outside of this river delta. So Adam and Eve stay around there. Cain kills Abel. Cain is forced by God as part of his punishment to go east. So Cain heads east and begins to multiply there and have his family grow. And then Adam and Eve have Seth, who becomes the key member of that family to carry on the lineage to ultimately to Jesus. It's awesome at this time, point in time too, to think that, well, one man is starting from nothing, but also to look at how long their lives at this very beginning of creation lasted. So our lives are generally humankind's create or beginnings start at the Garden of Eden and then around this Fertile Crescent. But as time goes on, families begin to expand. I believe, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So there's 9 generations between Adam and Noah. And you think, well, 9 generations. I don't know my great-great-great-great-grandfather. I couldn't even tell you much about them. But at this time, it's much different. So, and I included this chart because it's always really good to look at how different things were before the flood and how much longer people lived. If you look at Adam, he was alive when Methuselah was alive, when Enoch was alive. He wasn't, I mean, it had been a little bit over 100 years that since Adam died when Noah was born. But when Noah was alive, Methuselah was alive. And several of these other second, third, fourth generations. So it's just think that I might not be directly related to, and these people are all directly related, but I will know of, in a generally small area, I'll know third generation from Adam or second generation. I'll know people that knew the first man. That's hard for me to wrap my mind around that somebody lived 930 years or 969 years. But that certainly was the case. And it's interesting, the Methuselah is the most interesting of the examples. And Scott talked a little bit about this in class when we were studying this portion of Genesis. And if you look at the timeline, and there's a little notation here of when the flood is, and we can back up the years based on the biblical record. So the flood occurs at 1656 BC, and that is the same year that Methuselah died. So we don't know why. We know Methuselah only as he was the oldest man, and that he was the son of Enoch. Anybody know what's one thing we know about Enoch? He didn't die, right? So he was one of the two guys that we know of that didn't die. And he was on the earth, he was on the earth at the same time Methuselah was there. He was the father of Methuselah. And it's interesting, if you turn your Bibles, and this is going to be a weird reference for a class on Genesis, but Jude, the book of Jude, in verse 14 and 15, there's only one chapter. We know a little bit about Enoch. And this is just what Enoch was preaching. Jude, yeah, 14 and 15, sorry. Catch up on my notes. Now Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men also, saying, "Behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment on all, to convict all who are ungodly among them of all their ungodly deeds which they have committed in an ungodly way, and all of the harsh things which the ungodly sinners have spoken against him." So we know that Enoch was a preacher of righteousness, of a godly preacher, which, again, at this time, it's the first we hear. You know, we know that Noah ultimately was also a preacher of righteousness, but Enoch was his great-great-great-grandfather. He was righteous. And then Methuselah, his son, lives a very, very, very long time. In fact, he lives longer after his father died than his father lived his whole life. But he coincidentally, well, is it coincident, that he died when the flood came? Now, we can't know for sure at the reasoning for that, but if we look at, and I'm just going to, I'll preface this is my opinion, but we can look at, based on the fact that Enoch was righteous and he would have raised his son in a righteous manner, in a manner according to, you know, giving God the glory, I believe that Methuselah was a righteous man, and that he happened to die on the year that the flood came. Now, that could certainly be coincidental, and it could certainly be exactly the opposite. Methuselah was a horrible person. Fortunately, that won't have much effect on us because it was so long ago, but Methuselah lived a very long time. And if you look at this, as we're looking at this chart, and we're looking at a strata going straight down, you can see so much of the overlap. Once the flood happened, obviously, there's not going to be a lot of overlap after the flood because we start with Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth and their families. But Noah lived a very long time to the point where he was alive when Abraham was alive. That's interesting. Just to think that the first patriarch, God's chosen vessel to carry on the lineage to Jesus ultimately, was alive at the same time as Noah was. Well, actually, not. They weren't at the same time. They were very close together. Noah dies in 2006 BC, and Abraham was born in 2008. So they're very similar in the time frame that they were alive. So as we look at that, it's important context to understand as we're reading about the things that Noah did or the things that Abraham did. They weren't so far removed from the very beginning that they were disconnected from it. They understood how earth began, who the first man was, and how God interacted with them. And then the great flood comes. So we know from the biblical record, from Genesis, that God was displeased with his creation to the point where he decided he's going to destroy it all and start again. But he found righteous righteousness amongst the people, and he found Noah and saved him and his family in the ark. It's interesting to think about the consequences of this gigantic flood. Well, first off, we know that the whole earth was covered by water. Even David writes about it in Psalm 104. In Psalm 104, in verse 6, he says, "He set the earth on its foundations, so it should never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. And at your rebuke, they fled. At the sound of your thunder, they took flight. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place that you had appointed for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass, so that they might not again cover the earth." So we know from, the Genesis account, that all of the mountains were covered up to, I believe it was 6 cubits. So it's more than 20 feet. So what was the tallest mountain at that point? I would imagine Everest, if it existed pre-flood, was the tallest. That's a lot of water covering the earth. We know that it had to be that way because God was wiping out all of creation. When the entire earth is covered with water, there's nowhere for any animal to go, or human for that matter. We know that this flood that covered the earth from its beginning to where it receded completely away and Noah was able to leave the ark lasted approximately a year. And we know, again, that God purposely destroyed every man, woman, child. But he said, beasts that were in the water, beasts that were in the field, beasts that were in the air, everything perished except for those things that were on the ark. And I already read this verse, but this event changed what the earth looked like. Well, we will never know, apart from God telling us or revealing it to us in heaven, what the earth looked like before the flood. We know certainly what it looks like afterwards, but we can't know what it looked like beforehand. But as the account of the flood happened, Noah was in the ark, and the ark came to rest on Mount Ararat. We know the story of how he sent out doves and ravens to test whether he could leave the ark or not. But that's not the part that I want to look at. I want to look at, we know the set of mountains that he landed on. We know where Mount Ararat is, the mountains of Mount Ararat. It's in Turkey. You can see it on this map. This would be the Caspian Sea right here. Red Sea is down there. So, and if for those that aren't familiar with maps, and again, I should probably have done a little more explanation of this, all of this dark area, this kind of shaded area, it's all mountainous. It's not prime real estate for farming. So they landed in a pretty desolate spot, and I have a picture here of what Ararat looks like it today. Can you imagine stepping off a boat and having to walk down the mountain? That's just—it's hard to imagine what the experience would have been like for Noah. But this is the beginning, the re-beginning of mankind. So Noah takes his wife and his sons and their wives, leaves Mount Ararat, and begins to populate the earth. And as he is human nature, it starts to go wrong again, not very long after Noah had experienced that. But Noah was in the ark, and the water covered the earth for a long period of time, and he released all the animals. Going back, imagine, if you would, animals, all of the animals that were on the ark making their way down the mountain. That would just be a sight to behold. But Noah, fortunate for him, he was the only one, Noah and his family were the only ones that were able to experience it. So, again, we're still staying roughly in this Fertile Crescent area. Moved a little more north. It's funny that there's a biblical worldwide flood, but yet Noah landed after the flood was over in approximately the same area. So I would take that to mean that there probably weren't a lot of currents that happened during the flood to move him very far geographically across the globe. But he landed in Mount Ararat and began to populate the earth. They made their way back down towards the Tigris-Euphrates Delta, or the plain, and where they were able to, begin reestablishing their lives. So at this point, Noah and his family begin to have sons and daughters. Shem is the line. Shem is the one, the son of Noah, that ultimately fills the lineage to Christ. But we read about a lot of the descendants of Noah in Genesis. In Genesis chapter 10, there's a long discussion of all of the people that were, or the male heirs that were, maybe it wasn't all of them, but it certainly was a lot of them, that were part of Noah's lineage. And it's at this point where Noah and his family begin to populate the earth again, that as the population grows, mankind begins or continues to deviate from what God wanted them to do. God commanded Noah in Genesis 9 and verse 1, and it says, "So God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth.'" So God gives them a direct command. This is what you are to do. You are to. And it's not a hard one, right? It's live your normal life. Have kids and have your kids have kids and populate the earth. But notice it says populate the earth, not populate your home or populate where you want to stay. So God is giving them the command to go spread out across the earth and populate it. But that was not the intention of man. And one of the most, and it's got the most unique name, and I would ask the kids from the teen class because they don't remember it, but I won't put them on the spot. The individual in Noah's lineage, I believe it was his great-great-great-grandson, who was a mighty hunter, and his name was Nimrod, which is a funny name, but we know that he was the first mighty man, and that's what the word that's used in the biblical account. We understand it to mean that Nimrod was the first to go out and to start establishing cities. In fact, in Genesis chapter 10 and verse 8 and 9, it talks about particularly about Nimrod being a great hunter and the beginning of his kingdom, which is, this is the first time there's a kingdom. So what does a kingdom need? A king, right? And so this is the first time that we see that. And Nimrod begins to establish all of these cities and begins to establish his kingdom. And so as you imagine, what his goal is then is to set up cities that are relatively close together so he can rule over them. And so this is the first time. This is why he was mighty, in that he was beginning to set dominion over his peers that were on the earth. And at that time, it was relatively easy because everyone spoke the same language. It was the biggest advantage they had. So they could talk to each other without any encumbrances of language or language barriers. And so Nimrod set up, and the most well-known city that he set up was Babel. And I'm going to go out on a limb again here because I can, and you don't have to believe me because it's not straight from the Bible, but I believe that Babel and Babylon ultimately end up being the same place, approximately. This is in the same area where the Garden of Eden was approximately around here somewhere. It's where Adam and Eve lived. It's where most of mankind lived before the flood. And so this city was established. And their goal, and we know a lot about we talk about the Tower of Babel, but the tower in and of itself was unimportant. Their languages weren't confused because God was displeased that they built a tower. Am I ringing? Okay. Sorry, a little self-conscious on the microphone in front of me. Sorry. I digress.
I hear it too.
Yeah. All right. See, so I'm not alone. Kent, what are you doing to me? It wasn't the tower itself that was the problem. It was the people's attitude. We built this tower for the specific reason that we wanted everyone to see it and come in, come to us. We wanted to have one location where we all, we would call it a mega city, right? Where everybody came together and lived in the same area. I mean, that's great for Nimrod, right? As you can imagine, he established Babel. We don't know if he built the tower or not, but we know that he started the city. And that's great for him to try to bring everybody in so he can have dominion over everyone. If they were in close proximity to him, he could manage them a lot easier than if they were spread across the map, so to speak. But this is what displeased God. The fact that man was wanting to come together to become mighty amongst themselves and to become a great nation. And that's not what God had commanded Noah and his family. And you would have to imagine that these generations after Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth knew that their purpose was to go out and populate the earth. Well, they weren't doing it. And so God confused their languages. It's a little interesting to look at linguistic, and Steve Wilkes is really big into words and languages, and me, not so much. But it's interesting to look at right now, currently as it stands, there's approximately 7,000 languages, maybe a little bit less, distinct dialects and languages. At this point in time, there's one. But if we took all of the languages that exist today and broke them down, because there's so many that are related to each other, they're basically Spanish and the language that they speak in Spain are very similar to each other. It happens in just about every language has different versions. It would be like us. We have our dialect here in the Northwest and the South. They talk a lot different. And English in Britain is a lot different than, I mean, nuance, but it's a lot different than what how we speak. And so there's approximately 7,000 languages, but boiled down to the core, there are approximately 100 core languages where they can trace back where this proliferation of languages began. So about 100 languages differed. That is certainly within the realm of possibility of happening in Babel. If you could imagine Babel at this time, because we're talking about, six generations from Noah, six generations from there being six people on the earth. I mean, we're talking about in the thousands of people, even if they had reproduced every day, or not every day, but every year. You can't reproduce every day. Every year they had a child. I mean, we'd still be talking about the thousands of people. And so we know that when God confused the languages, that groups of people started to move off together. So not everyone got a distinct language that was alive. In fact, many stayed with the same language that they were currently speaking. They weren't confused, and they stayed where they were. But those that were not able to communicate with those around them found those that they could communicate with, and they moved off. They moved off into other places. And it's within the realm of possibility, obviously, it's likely that those 100 approximately, maybe a bit fewer than that, of those original languages that led to our languages today had their origin at the Tower of Babel. It's also interesting to know, as we list out the lineage of Noah, the lineage of Shem, which is the chosen line. He has one, two, three. So from Shem, there's five generations to Peleg, which was his great, 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 great grandson, was alive was around at the Tower of Babel event. And we know that because it mentions that Peleg was alive when there was a division of men. So at Babel, everyone's confused. Well, groups are confused and they move off, but the lineage still remains the same. So from Peleg, which is, again, the fourth generation after Shem, we get five more generations to Abraham. So we're not far off. This Tower of Babel event is not more than, 100 years till Abraham. My animation's really I tried to fix all those, but they're supposed to be arrows. So from Babel, everybody, so we know that their world was populated. And it's interesting, I had some pictures. So these are what are called ziggurats. You would be your bottom, yeah, it's the same as me. The bottom left-hand corner is the artist's rendition of what maybe the Tower of Babel could possibly have looked like. But each one of these other structures are spread out across the earth. So there's one from Mexico, there's examples from China, from South America, which is not included here. This one in Iraq is rebuilt to look like the ziggurat that existed in Ur, where Abraham was from. So this spread of this construction format was, again, proliferated across the globe. So you can see it in many different places. So, I mean, it shows that people carried their technology with them, their advancements with them, and they started to do these things. I mean, and I don't show it, but there's also some of these things, same things in France and England as well. So from Babel, from going from the Fertile Crescent, man has lived in the Fertile Crescent for the entirety of their creation up to the point of Babel. And that was God's purpose, right? God's purpose, he said, to go and populate the entire earth. So from there, they all spread out. Each part of the earth, you can imagine at this point, I like to think the English started at Babel, some form of it, and that was carried over to England or even potentially to one of the North America, South America, it's probably England. And from there, it kind of spreads out. So this is the cradle of time, or the cradle of man. This is the cradle of history as well. And the next person in the line of the lineage that is of importance, certainly, like as I mentioned, there were seven other or eight generations from Shem. Eight generations from Shem to Abraham. So there was a good bit of time, but none of those individuals during that time had anything significant that happened to them. It's when Abraham comes on the scene and God calls him out that we start to see what God's plan for mankind is. So this is another, and I like these. These kind of remind me of those felt boards we had when we were kids. I kind of enjoy, it harkens back to my childhood. Artist rendition of what Ur would have looked like. So Ur of the Chaldees is where Abraham is from. And there are actually, and I don't know if I have a picture of it, we'll see. There are archaeological sites that show a lot of these building footprints, and the actual footprint of the ziggurat in Ur also exists today. And I'll go back to this map. So Ur, at the time, was a population center. It was very affluent. It was a city that was on the river. That was a port city, so they had a lot of commerce going to and from. As you imagine, as man spreads out, the need to get things from one group of people to another becomes important, and trade starts to happen, and those that have access to the trade routes are the ones that end up being the most wealthy. So we come in, if you didn't catch where this was, so Ur is, again, in the lower Mesopotamia, this delta. This is where Abraham is from. And this is a current aerial photo, I believe. It's 2019. So this is something that, exists today. And you can see that there are a lot of old building footprints and whatnot through here. And this is kind of the part that's the most interesting, is the 3D rendering of what the ziggurat looks like, and the sizes and the scope of it. It's pretty amazing. I mean, it's large centimeters. We're not metric. So we're talking about, 200, 300 feet long, 150 feet wide, 30 feet tall, made out of stone. Again, very distinctly the same shape and structure as all those other, we call them monuments, temples, I think of what they've been called. Really, the kind of that ziggurat design is seen throughout the earth, and roughly, approximately the same time frame. So I don't have a picture. Okay, so Ur is where Abraham starts, and we're running out of time, so we'll just briefly cover this, and then I kind of set it up to be where I can, if I'm ever asked to teach a class again, I can just jump right back into this. So I have it canned, so it's kind of nice. But Ur is where Abraham starts. Abraham and his wife, his father's name is Terah. And Terah, before God calls Abraham, Terah's son, Nahor, who is Lot's father, dies. And Lot becomes the responsibility of his grandfather. And they carry, so Terah, Abraham, Lot, and Sarah all take all of their possessions, which, again, coming from Ur is a lot of stuff. And they make the trip from Ur to Haran. And I got the marker there on the map. This is a long distance. We're talking 600 miles, and this is not 600 miles on an airplane, or 600 miles on a car, or even a donkey. This is 600 miles by foot. And so we're talking about months of travel with a large contingent of people and constant threat of, you know, being robbed, persecuted, whatever it might be for their wealth. But they moved from Ur to Haran. And Haran is a much smaller in scale than Ur was. In fact, it's thought that once Abraham ultimately leaves Haran, that Haran was abandoned for many, many, many years before another nationality came and took over the area. So they move from Ur to Haran, and it's where at Haran that Abraham's father dies, Abraham's father Terah, and Lot becomes the responsibility of Abraham. And it's also where God gives, makes Abraham the threefold promise. And he also, I mean, he calls him out. He calls him to leave his land. So between Ur and Haran, this is all the area of, this is the home of Abraham. So Haran was his home. Ur was his home. I would imagine the places in between. You can look, I added a couple of big cities. So Babylon was included in that area. Nineveh was a little bit to the north and east. So this is all, this is teeming with life at this point. It's the most populated area in the world. And this is where Abraham's from. And God calls Abraham to leave that opulence and to leave the comfort of, we all have the home, our home comforts, to leave your comfort of home and go somewhere. He doesn't tell him where. He just says, you're going to go somewhere. And Abraham does as God tells him to do. And that is where we will stop and maybe pick up some other time in the indeterminate future. Thank you for your attention.